Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, welcome back to another week, everyone. I am Joe Saul Sehi from Stacky Benjamins, and we're going to throw this party over to Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt in just a second. But have you ever wondered about all of that social media chatter that's out there and if there's a way to capitalize on it? Well, guess what? Your wait's over because the same artificial intelligence techniques some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds used is now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, which is licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. What does that mean? They don't survey, they don't guess, they just listen to the chatter online. They target the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape, and the more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of those most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. The 75 stocks that have the most bullish scores, they include those in the index. So each month, they're looking to track and capture the latest big data-driven insights and roll them up into the index. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to Buzz Index and more information. A little disclaimer, I invest in the Buzz Index. Doesn't mean it's right for you. You should do your own homework, but I need to tell you that I invest. All right, let's throw this show over to my friend, Doug Goldstein.
Hey, this is Doug Goldstein. I am here in Jerusalem. The noise you hear behind me is a major parade that's happening right now as we're recording the show. It's Jerusalem Day. Hundreds of thousands of people are dancing in the streets. It's very exciting here. Hope you enjoy the music in the background, as in just a moment, we'll be listening to my interview with Stig Brodersen. And then after that, we'll listen to the fantastic panel of the Money Tree Podcast, Joe Saul Sehi, Linda P. Jones, and Miranda Marquette. I'm very happy to be talking with Stig Brodersen, who is the host of one of the top podcasts on iTunes. In fact, the number one podcast in the stock investing category on iTunes. The show is called The Investors Podcast. Stig, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Doug. Thanks for inviting me.
So you talk a lot about stock investing. In fact, you often talk about stock investing 101, which I think a lot of people sort of overlook. They think, oh, well, I invest in stocks, but they don't get really how complicated it is. Is it in fact complicated, do you think, for people to make money investing in stocks?
No, I don't think it's complicated, but it's definitely very time-consuming. And I think that's probably one of the problems that we are facing as investors because, hey, we're all busy, right? And how much research do we actually really need to put into our stock research? And I think that the answer to that really surprises a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the answer? How much research do you have to put in?
I'm glad you asked. Think about it like this first. Think about how long it takes for you to save enough money to start investing in stocks in the first place. And then think about, well, how much time do you actually spend finding a stock? So for most people, whenever they find a stock, they would say, I go to Starbucks every day. I really like the coffee. I will go buy Starbucks stock. And, you know, that might seem like a reasonable approach for most people. And I definitely suggest that you actually do invest in goods and services that you like. But think about it like this. Say that you would be buying a house. Well, buying a house, you would probably like to know how many square feet. You want to know how many rooms. You would like to know the location. You would know a lot of different things. But whenever it comes to stock investing, it seems to be like, well, we don't need to know all the details. I think the stock price will go up. It's really important to separate the two because the key question is, how much is it worth? So, Doug, you probably wouldn't buy your home if it was 10 times as expensive as it really were. No, because you're thinking about the valuation. And it's the same with stocks.
Well, the problem with thinking about valuation, in fact, I'm glad you bring up this very example because I'm dealing with it now. My siblings and I and my mother are dealing with selling the house which my parents owned for about 50 years. And we met with a few agents, and interestingly, all of the agents gave a certain price that they said the house was worth, and my siblings and I, we all thought it was worth about 20% more because we're laughing because we sort of think that's what we wanted it to be worth, and we said, a house especially, and we can talk about stocks in a minute, how does anyone know what the intrinsic value is of a house? You know, it's a property, but you have to look into things like the school district and the neighbors. There's so many unknowns and so many moving parts. How could you make a decision about something that's only one thing that you own, let alone trying to understand what the value is of some traded stock?
You know, Doug, I'm really happy you brought us this example about your own home. That is actually the most difficult thing to value for anyone, especially if you live in the home. So let me give you some stats here. And this was done after the crash in the US after 2009. And they asked how many people actually saw real estate prices overall in the States go down. And it was about 80%. Now, then, when they got the question, do you think your home has decreased in price, when almost the entire of the United States has decreased? You know what this
is? I see where this is going. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, two-thirds. Two-thirds of people replying to this said, well, at least their home kept its value. It might even have gone up.
Wow.
It's just, and there's, you know, there's so much emotional attachment. I would say, you know, for your home, I mean, you grew up there, you have a lot of positive emotions. That's the best home in the world. And why can't we all see that? Why are we not willing to pay 20% more for that? The problem is, it's unfortunately your memories.
So it's not.
And it also tells.
I want to challenge that. I'm not sure it's my memories. I really know what the house is worth. And I believe, and this is where you can correct me, I believe that the agents are just anxious to do a sale. So they're willing to give it a price that's 20% less in order to make it go quickly. And then they can, you know, put another notch in their lipstick case and say, and yet another house was sold.
Yeah, you know, and I definitely think there is something to it. If you look at, in general, if people have interest of selling something, typically by commission, they would typically say a lower price because the turnover, the time it takes to turn over a home is actually very expensive for the agent. But if you actually would like a really, really good answer to how much your home is worth, you should go ask your neighbors. Studies actually show that the neighbors in general are really good at valuing your home because they're a lot more objective about it, and they also know a lot more about the neighborhood.
Interesting. We're talking with Stig Brodersen, who is, in fact, very interesting. You can hear him on the Investors Podcast, which is rated number one in the stock investing categories on iTunes. So interesting, Stig, you're saying to ask your neighbors. So let's relate that, for example, to the stock market, where you're going to ask people who may not have an interest in a particular stock. For example, stock analysts. I'm not talking about stock analysts who would have an interest. Maybe they work for an investment bank, and so therefore they might give a company a very high rating in order to, on the other side of the table, win the investment banking business. But a stock analyst who maybe is an independent or an independent money manager or fund manager whose only goal is to make money for himself and his clients, because let's say he earns a percentage of the profits or a percentage of the value of the portfolio, why is there a problem, or is there a problem, asking someone like that to help you to value a stock and figure out when it's trading below its true value so you could buy it?
Well, there doesn't have to be a problem. Very often, though, there is a problem because it's very difficult to make those interests align of the advisor and the client. Depending on how you're compensated, most advisors would be compensated, as you suggest, Doug, as a percentage, which means that the advisor would also have an incentive to pick very volatile stock for the sake of being volatile, because since they're getting a cut of how much it would go up, well, why not take a stock that fluctuates a lot? That's something that we see very, very often. And very often the client would have to pay the downside, but had to share the upside.
So that's maybe referring to a hedge fund. Hedge funds will often take a percentage of the profits, and they might even have a high watermark, which means that until they achieve that level again, they don't get a percentage of the profits. Let's talk about, for example, a mutual fund or a managed account where the money manager is simply getting a percentage of the value of the portfolio. So the only way for the managers to increase their income is to increase the size of their portfolio, of the client's portfolio, and that's a disincentive for them to buy extra volatile stocks, because if they crush the client, then A, their income gets crushed and the client leaves.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I agree with that. And I'm really happy we're having this discussion because we learn the most whenever we have disagreements. I can definitely see your argument. Yes, there would be a lot of reason for them not to pick volatile stocks. And it is true. Very often they would take, you know, very stable stocks. And, you know, there's this old saying on Wall Street, you can never get fired by picking IBM. But what happens for a lot of these big mutual funds is that they spend a lot of the money than the clients have on marketing, because they are, yes, they are compensated on their performance, but actually two-thirds on average of the revenue that they're achieving, that's from the expense ratio, that is from the fees they're charging for the money they're managing. So that's also why you see a lot of these funds are very expensive and all the money are spent on marketing.
Okay, so let's go back to what you said before. You were saying, ask your neighbors what the value of your house might be. And then I tried to turn that around to a question of, so who should you ask about the value of a stock? So who should you ask about the value of a stock?
Well, I think the easiest thing for me, or the simplest thing for me, was to say you need to calculate it yourself. Or you need to find a person who you really trust and who has the same investment strategy like you. At the end of the day, the value of a business is how much money it generates. And I know it's, I make it sound simple, that's basically just it. So let me just give you a quick rule of thumb. On average, in the US, a stock would be trading somewhere around 15 to 17 times earnings. So on average, you'll be spending $15 to $17 for $1 of earnings, or what translates to around 6.6% return.
So explain that a little bit further. Let's go into this. What, you know, off the cuff, you said 15 to 17 times earnings is a normal PE, which is a little bit below, I think, what the S&P 500 is for now, but I'm not sure that's the right index to look at in any case. But why is that the normal? Why shouldn't it be 5 times earnings or 25 times earnings?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And if you ask the academics, they would say, well, that is how much risk, or that is the return that investors will require for the amount of risk that they're taking on by investing in that asset class. But we can more or less see that the GDP growth for a country, something like, for instance, like United States, it follows the stock market, and then there is a what we call a risk premium by investing in stocks.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that people are willing to pay more than a risk-free asset in order to try to make more money, let's say compared to bank deposits or treasury bonds.
Yes, that's correct, because it's perceived to be a higher risk. Also because, as we talked about, stocks would be more volatile and people could lose their money a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. And you end up also with the possibility of a herd mentality, meaning if someone's willing to pay 14 times earnings for a stock, and then he says, well, you know, maybe it looks pretty good, I'll pay 15 or 16 or 17 times earning. All of a sudden, he's paying a lot more for that stock than when it was at 14 times earnings. And I think the problem is, and it goes back all the way to the beginning of what we were saying, is how people make decisions emotionally, like I was, based on the house that we're looking to sell. You know, it feels to me like maybe it's worth more, but that's not what the true market value is. I guess that's where people have to really be concerned.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point. And you see, you know, really hype stocks like Amazon and Tesla. I mean, more or less, they're not making any kind of money. But the reason why people are willing to pay a lot of money for the stock is that they expect growth. Now, I'm not here to say that Amazon would be a bad stock or Tesla would be a bad stock, but the companies need to grow a lot and they need to make a lot of money before it can justify the valuation. And that's why, just like a really quick rule of thumb, if you need to invest in stocks, if you would like to value stocks, look at how much money that they're making and don't pay more than 10 or 12 times the earnings.
Interesting. All right, Stig, I think that's some very good advice you've given us and some real insight about how to look at stocks. Unfortunately, we are just about out of time. So tell me in the last few seconds, how can people follow you and follow your work?
You know, they can tune in to theinvestorspodcast.com. We study billionaires and we study the financial markets. So please check it out.
Okay, we'll put a link to that at today's show notes. Thanks very much, Stig Brodersen.
Thank you, Doug.
All right. Thanks, Doug, for that awesome discussion. Hey, we're about to move to the second part of today's show where our crack team of roundtable guests discuss everything related to today's interview. But before we get to that, I asked Jamie Wise from the Buzz Index about how the Buzz Index works that's different than surveys. And here's what Jamie had to say.
Independence, in a word, that's what it's all about. The wisdom of crowds is all about a very large, diverse number of people independently and freely volunteering information, completely opposite from a survey where you're forced into several choices. You have significant opportunities for response bias, for agreeing with the collective, a whole different structure to that type of environment, which allows you to create greater insights from wisdom of crowds and from online content as opposed to polling content.
So no surveys, no guessing. Just listening, head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ, ticker symbol BUZ if you want to invest. I invest in the Buzz Index. Doesn't mean it's right for you, but check it out. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for the link to the Buzz Index and more information. All right, and let's go back to the parade in Jerusalem. And our friend Doug Goldstein joins us. Nice interview, Doug.
Thanks very much. I hope you're enjoying the background music as we have a discussion today. But as we get started, let's say hello to Miranda Marquardt. Miranda, how are things going with you?
They're okay. If you think it sounds like I'm a little stuffed up, it's because I am. So the right. pollen has attacked me and it is winning this battle. But I've got tea, I've got drugs, I've got essential oils. I'm basically trying everything but nasal spray. And I hate the idea of nasal spray, but I'm rapidly getting to the point where I may actually try it.
Nasal spray is going to be your BFF?
Oh, gosh. I really hope not. But the tea and the essential oils don't seem to be doing it, so it may be time for drastic measures.
Oh, boy.
Nasal spray. What an attractive option. Linda P. Jones, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Doug. I love the sound of the parade going on there. Pretty exciting.
Y'all should come over and take a look for yourselves. And Joe Salcihi, what's happening in your world?
I'm all hopped up on nasal spray. I don't even know what that is. Don't try that at home, kids. That was a joke. It was a joke.
Hey, Joe, every week you talk about the Buzz Index, and it kind of reminds me of something that Stig said in the interview. You always tell people, you talk about it, and then you say, but, and then you say that as a disclaimer, you own some shares of the Buzz Index, ETF, and then you say, but listeners should do their own research. How much time should people actually spend, you think, researching an investment?
I don't think there's a downside to ever doing more and more research. I mean, at some point, you got to pull the trigger, right? But I don't think I can ever know enough about what I own. And it's interesting. What I've found is that in the past, clients that knew really well the heartbeat of the company had a better sell discipline, I've found. And by the way, I have no empirical data on this. I just always felt like people knew if they felt the way the company acted when a good time was to sell and were less emotional about the sale. So everything from reading the annual report, the baloney stuff that's supposedly from the CEO that really their public relations people wrote at the beginning gives you a feel through understanding the numbers. At minimum, I think you should spend, you know, if you're going to buy an individual stock or a bond, 3 or 4 hours a year.
Oh, a year. Wow. Joe, interesting. You said no empirical data on your study that people who know more about an investment have a better sell discipline. I was thinking it's just the opposite. A lot of times I find I work with doctors and they love to buy stocks in pharmaceutical companies because they feel they know so much about it. And with all due respect to all of our listeners out there who are doctors, they're just like the worst stock pickers. And they have no discipline whatsoever. They just have a great deal of confidence.
But I don't think, though, Doug, just to go back, I think there's a difference there. I think those are people that are in love with the company versus understanding the heartbeat of the company. Like if I like a drug, that doesn't mean that I understand how the company that makes it actually works. So you have to distinguish between loving the product and understanding the management team and the process they use to bring new things to market.
Got it. Well, Joe wants a new drug. Linda, what about you? Tell us how you think that people should be looking at a company if they know so much about it. You know, one of the problems of people research a company, I actually think they come to like it more just because they've invested time in it and it's harder for them to sell it. You think that's true?
I think that I think a lot of people start out doing their research by their products, which is not where I recommend that people start, actually. But many people just go by, you know, what are they using? What do they like in their life? That kind of thing. Just like the example you're saying with the doctors and the drug companies. And they really need to start at what, you know, how's the relative strength going in the market? How is the stock actually performing? What are the earnings? How is the profitability? Is it increasing each year? These are important things. You know, Warren Buffett reads the annual reports of companies, and how many investors that invest in individual stocks actually even look at the annual report? I think it's a very small number.
Yeah. So I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked Joe, which is how much time do you think someone should actually spend on his investments or her investments?
I don't think it's a factor of time. I mean, I think, you know, saying somebody should spend 12 hours or 20 hours, it just time to me isn't really the question. It's really getting to know the right factors around the stock and what's really going on with the company and finding out how is it performing and what are their earnings looking like and what are their products that are coming out? Do they have a wide moat around them like Warren Buffett talks about, or are they subject to competitors that can come in and steal their market share? Is this something that's a long-term trend that they can stick with? You know, there's a lot of things like that I think you have to have ongoing monitoring once you make that decision. There's the research that goes into making the decision to put the company in your portfolio. And then there's, you know, the monitoring from there doesn't take a lot of time, but you do just have to keep up on what's going on with the company.
All right, Linda and Joe, neither of you are giving me the answer I want to hear. So let me try Miranda. Miranda, if you were to ask someone to manage money for you and she said, okay, I'm going to spend 5 hours a year on your portfolio, would you say, whoa, really? That's all you're going to spend? That's enough time to make a determination about whether to buy or sell some securities? Does that sound reasonable to you, or do you think people should be spending more time?
Oh my gosh. This is a terrible question to ask me. I'm not going to give you the answer you want either, because the reality of the situation is I literally have a robo-advisor that probably spends less than that amount of time managing my portfolio. Right? Because I index through like Betterment, but I also index through other, you know, I use a broker. I use a more traditional online broker, but I use one of those too to invest in an index fund. So I'm basically managing it myself. But once again, I probably spend less than 5 hours a year managing my own portfolio.
Wow, I can't get any of you to agree with me.
I know, right?
I feel
5 hours is plenty of time when you're an indexer.
That's true. It's true. You know, the joke that we often make is that people spend more time planning a one-week vacation than they do planning a 40-year retirement. So it just seems to me that if you are going to manage, especially individual stocks, you got to spend time doing the research,
yeah.
Which is why I tell people who don't want to do that, outsource it to money managers who, gosh, I really hope they're spending more time on it.
Yeah. And I would like to say, though, I mean, just because I'm to the point where I'm probably spending less than 5 hours a year managing my investment portfolio, I did spend more time than that figuring out the retirement planning aspect of it, because I did go through a retirement needs assessment where I sat down and I said, okay, how much do I think I'm going to need each month when I hit retirement? How much do I think I'm going to need to save up to reach my retirement goals? How much am I going to have to do each month? You know, the Employee Benefits Research Institute says less than half of American workers have actually thought about what they're going to need in retirement. They're just, you know, willy-nilly putting money away. And so even though I may not manage my portfolio actively or for very much time during the year, I have sat down and I have performed that needs and I have said, okay, with the asset allocation that I have, how much do I need to put in each month to go toward my retirement goals? And then I automate that and just have that going with my indexing strategy. So I did take some time initially to put this kind of plan into place, but maintaining the plan does not take very long.
Mm-hmm. So you said half the people have thought about the money they need for retirement.
Less than half. Yeah, less than half, according to the Employee Benefits Research Institute, have done this.
Let's do a study of the Money Tree Investment Podcast panel. So, Miranda, you've done it. Linda, have you done this? Have you calculated how much you need for retirement?
Absolutely.
All right, two. Joe?
Yeah, I mean, that's for me. You know, I've got that very simple equation that I think everyone needs to solve for, and that's the basis of the entire equation.
Nice. And me too. So, okay. So we are obviously not a representative sample that you were describing. So let's go back for those of us who, or for those of you, because I think I'm just not seeing it like you guys. If you want to be efficient at managing your portfolio and making decisions, are there certain shortcuts that you've found to make a smart decision or to research a specific stock? Joe, how about you?
Well, I actually, you know, it's funny. I'm going to deflect to Linda because I seriously think that you find a set of criteria that are important to you, that you found work, and you stick to those criteria. And so you build yourself a series of filters. And then you work that system. If you read, there's a great book out there. I've been referencing this book a lot lately. There's actually more than one, but it's called Stock Market Wizards. And it's fascinating to see people that are great at individual investments. They have a system that they built. They stick to the discipline of that system. They don't deviate until they find that the system no longer works. And when the system no longer works, they figure out which piece of it doesn't work and they fix the system instead of emotionally changing course. That's the problem most individuals have, I think, is that they don't have that disciplined system like Linda has.
Okay, so Linda, Joe is leaning to you. Linda, what's a shortcut, let's say, that people could use in order to have a system that they can track and stick with the system?
Well, back when I was first starting to invest in individual stocks, I read the book How to Make Money in Stocks by William J. O'Neill. And that gave me a lot of information about what winning stocks look like, what their chart patterns look like, what their relative strength, their earnings. And of course, William J. O'Neill started Investor's Business Daily, where he routinely ranks companies, gives you the top performing stocks. He gives you all of the information that we used to have to go to the library and get years ago to get that. It was, you know, published in volumes and whatever in the library, or you had to subscribe to it and it was very expensive. And now it's very inexpensive through Investor's Business Daily. So I think they're an amazing publication that does a lot of that legwork for you. And so, you know, individual stock investing isn't for everybody. I don't really recommend it for most people because it does take time. It does take discipline. It does take a lot of learning before people really get the hang of it. I mean, that's why professionals do it. And even professionals aren't outperforming the indices. So I think, you know, people need to really put the time in and do the discipline rather than just, you know, doing what most people do, which is like Stig said, they drink Starbucks coffee, so they buy Starbucks. That's just not the right way to pick a stock. And I think you really have to put the time in, the education, the learning. And so, you know, read some books. I like Joe's book too, Market Wizards. I think that's a great book as well.
Mm-hmm. Miranda, your shortcut seems to be the probably one of the most intelligent shortcuts out there, which is just buy index funds because you don't have to make any specific decisions about individual equities. And you get a broadly diversified portfolio. Is that your number one shortcut, or do you have a shortcut for picking the shortcuts?
Yeah, that's pretty much my number one shortcut, honestly. you've nailed
it. Out.
But yeah, I mean, basically, I look for an index fund with as broad a swath of the market as I can. I love the S&P 500 index funds. I love an all market fund. I love an all world fund. I love these. And, you know, I even have an emerging markets bond fund. I love all of these types of funds because they encompass a large swath of the market. So basically, the bigger the swath of the market I can get in my portfolio, the happier I am, because to me, it's really just more about like riding that wave of the future and everything. And really, when it gets right down to it, if everything goes completely to pot and market performance just completely crashes and burns and everything that we've seen historically in terms of market growth turns on its head, the bottom line is we're probably going to be in a state of complete civilization breakdown. And the fact that I've lost all the money in the stock market is going to be the least of my worries. So yeah, so basically I just try and cast as wide a net as possible and try and just ride the wave.
And I think that's a good strategy for most people, by the way, Doug. I think most people should have like an ETF portfolio or a mutual fund portfolio and let the professionals do it for you, or let the broad market index, if you're going to do it yourself, you know, have the broad market diversification, I think is wise for the majority of people.
Well, which is funny because I think a lot of people dive into fees, and definitely the sexy thing to talk about is fees. And the big key, I think, for most investors is the appropriate asset allocation. Study after study has shown that having the right mix of assets is the key to your success if you're going to be an index investor versus having the lowest cost fund. And I'm not saying that having the lowest cost fund isn't important. It is important. I just think it's way sexier to talk about that. Well, people that we talk to at the Stacky Benjamin show that are so obsessed with fees and have the crappiest mix of funds. And right. it's just they're chasing the wrong dragon.
The wrong thing.
Chasing the wrong thing.
Yeah, I actually like best the way Miranda said it. She's a big swath investor. That was your phrase, and you said, of course, that you're investing in pot. You said if the world goes to pot, that's where you're going.
Investing in pot.
I'm trying to figure out.
You can invest in pot today.
As we head to hell in a handbasket. No, I mean, really, though, honestly, if your broad market investment turns out to be a complete loser over the course of 30 years, then you know that there's been a major civilization breaking event that has happened toward the end of that 30 years. And that is, and at that point,
cannabis investing might be a good idea, right?
I hope you've invested in food storage and ammo. I mean, let's be real.
Yeah, we should bring on a guest to talk about that one because I've wondered about that.
You know, I've got preppers that we can bring on to talk about.
Or Harry Dent talks about demographics and the lack
thereof. They're in my family, you guys.
Yeah, well,
And my neighbors.
I mean, it's interesting because Harry Dent talks about demographics being, you know, an issue where the market may not perform well in the future just because we have fewer people born and fewer people consuming and parents not buying things for kids, and that slows down the economy. So it doesn't mean that we had to go to hell in a handbasket in the economy. It could, maybe Harry's theory is right. I don't know.
By the way, I just wanted to bring up that Miranda is only investing in pot for medicinal purposes because she clearly isn't feeling well.
I'm not investing in pot for any reason because it's illegal in Idaho. Please don't come arrest me.
So if you're looking to invest in something, and it seems to me I'm simply asking all the wrong questions today to get the answers that I was looking for, because I wanted to say that there's a way to get a lot of information.
Why don't you just tell us what you want us to say?
This is what I want to say.
Send us a script ahead of time.
What are you looking for?
Tell us what you want us to say, Doug. We're not mind readers.
Thank you. I really clearly made a mistake in preparing for this. I think that when people are trying to invest and trying to get to really put their mind to work so that they can be smart investors, they need to look at some very basic ratios and basic numbers like the price earnings ratio. They need to look at book value if they're going to be a value investor. And a great source of that is obviously the internet has everything. But personally, I just like the layout on a site like Yahoo Finance, where you can get a lot of this information to begin to make a smart decision. So let's talk about smart decisions. In the event that you were looking at a stock, what would be the first ratio or number that you would look at? Joe, I'll start with you.
Oh, man.
Now you know what I'm looking for. I think I've been clear. So please answer the way I want you to answer, okay?
So the first thing that I look at is free cash flow. And I want to see increasing free cash flow. That's what I want to see.
Nice. Linda?
I'm going to look at earnings, but you asked specifically for a ratio. And so I think what you're looking for is PE ratio.
But figured it out.
What's interesting is that Stig talked about 15 to 17 on average, which is correct. And then he said 10 to 12 is the PE ratio that he looks for. PE ratio, of course, price divided by earnings equals a number. The average over history is somewhere between 15 to 17 on the S&P 500. He's looking at companies that have a below average PE ratio. 10 to 12 times earnings means all of his stocks are going to be slanted toward value stocks, and he's going to miss all the high growth companies because they typically sell above the average PE ratio, and you're going to miss your Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple. You're going to miss all of those companies. Not that you have to always buy tech stocks, but I'm just saying, if you put a deep constraint on PE ratio, you're going to miss high growth companies because they typically are always expensive. They always have high PE ratios. Sometimes they have astronomical PE ratios, or at least double PE ratios of the average. So, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that is what it is. And if your constraints are that they always have to be below average, then your universe is much smaller in terms of what stocks and companies you're going to be able to choose from.
That's a good point. I like PE ratio too, but I like it. I think kind of what Linda's getting at is I like it as a comparative tool much more than a hard and fast rule, right? If I'm comparing three stocks that are in the same sector, the one with the lower P ratio may be a better value buy than one that's less. And the key word there is maybe, because I like this, the kind of scientific approach that I've got this stock that has a much lower P ratio than stocks it competes against, not Apple and Orange like a tech stock and a railroad stock. But if I'm looking at all the railroads and one has a lower PE, I'm going to look for what's wrong with this company and why are fewer people investing in it, or why is the company closer to the ground? Is there something bad that happened? Is there PE ratio as a first line of defense is great. PE ratio by itself, I think, is crap.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think comparing and actually comparing apples to apples is critical. Miranda, do you have a number or something you start off at, or something that you start off with when you begin to look at an investment?
Yeah, how big of a swath of the market does it cover?
Big swath.
But I do agree that if you're going to look into individual stocks, I think looking at the fundamentals, using a fundamental analysis approach is a good idea. And that includes what Joe was talking about with the free cash flow, looking at the PE ratio, looking at your profit margins, looking at the management and how they manage the company. Those kinds of things can help you get an idea of whether the company is strong. You can even look and see, if I was going to invest in an individual stock, I would also, I honestly, I start with the Dividend Aristocrats list. I just go straight to that list. And I just say, well, these are companies that have been able to raise their dividend every year, at least for at least 25 years. So that means that they probably have good fundamentals to begin with, and then you can dig into the fundamentals from there. So that's kind of where I go if I'm looking for ideas on a place to start. If I were going to invest in individual stocks, I would start with the Dividend Aristocrat list. So not very scientific, not very...
What, starting with a reasonable place? You're looking in a place that's already pre-screened.
Exactly. So that's kind of, you know, where I would go if I was going to look for ideas to begin with.
And that brings us near the end. And I just want to bring this back to what we said in the beginning, which was, if someone's going to have a portfolio of stocks, which a lot of people like doing, if you're going to look at every stock and look at the management and the dividend increases and the debt and the free cash flow and the PE, it's going to take you a lot of time. So therefore, I think it lends a lot of credence to the Miranda model, which is, if you're not going to spend a lot of time really studying the stocks, do something that's very, very broadly based. And sorry, and Linda, of course, and Joe, I think, agreed with this as well. If you're not going to spend the time really studying this, don't go there. You know, you can do it for fun and to talk about, but don't put your money into things unless you're really going to understand what you have. And that's a wrap before anyone can, you know, argue with me. Let's wrap it up here. I think we're just about out of time, but and I think the parade just ended, so
of course.
We quieted out here on Jerusalem Day just as we finish up. But hey, in last minute, Linda P. Jones, tell us what is going on in your world.
Well, over at Be Wealthy and Smart, we follow billionaires too. And we did a podcast recently on daily habits of 6 billionaires. So you can see what they do differently and what they do similarly. And maybe it'll help you be a billionaire.
Yeah, that was fun when you interviewed Miranda, Joe, and me for that episode. Joe, what's going on in your world?
Right. I'm talking to Dave O'Connor. He did a project that I think we all were interested in several months ago, which was called Not Your Guru. It was a Tony Robbins, and followed him through one of his big seminars. He has a new program out with National Geographic, which is Year Million, where they look into the future. And so we talk about robots taking over everything, artificial intelligence, what are humans going to do? What's the economy going to look like? What's the role of money? We're going to talk with Dave O'Connor about all that.
Wow, that sounds very, very interesting. And Miranda Marquette, in your world, what's doing?
Yeah, so if you run over to studentloanhero.com, you might see some interesting things about what's going on with the politics. And I know we don't do politics here, but, you know, the new budget proposal is out from the president. We've got all sorts of things happening that could affect your finances as a result of this budget. And, you know, there's tax reform happening, the healthcare thing, all of those things can impact your budget. So head on over to studentloanhero.com. We've got breaking news. We've got analysis and ideas from both sides. So we're actually covering it from both sides of, you know, the perspectives, and you can kind of get an idea of what you might expect in the future, depending on what actually ends up happening.
That sounds great. What's going on at the Rich as a King podcast these days, in line with what we spoke about today, is the most recent episode talks about using certain metrics to analyze stocks. That's at richasaking.com. Hope you enjoy that. I hope you check out all of the panels, podcasts, and websites. And of course, when you're checking out the Money Tree Investment Show, we really appreciate if you leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to the shows, and tell your friends on Twitter and Facebook. Hey, Miranda, can you take us out?
Yes. Make sure you check us out at moneytreepodcast.com. You can see all of our episodes and see some resources and learn a little bit more about each of the panelists. Also, make sure you subscribe to us over at Apple Podcasts. You can do that through our site, moneytreepodcast.com, or just head over to Apple Podcasts and search for the Money Tree Investing Podcast. You can find us there. We are also available on Stitcher. So make sure you subscribe to us there if that is your preferred listening platform. And don't forget to ask us questions. We've got more listener question episodes coming up. We know you love to hear those. We don't know why, but people keep asking us questions and want our advice. So we'll have more listener question episodes in the near future. So make sure you get us your questions. And don't forget, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.